It's The Wonky Show. We're just back from Labour's conference in Liverpool, where Keir Starmer made some positive noises about universities. There are concerns mounting about anti-Semitism in HE following the Hamas attack in Israel, and we're asking where to draw the line when it comes to regulating student mental health. It's all coming up.
But I think our job is to try to point out, if you keep doing that, if you don't address the trajectory of that line, you cannot possibly imagine this system will be delivering the kind of quality that we'd all expect it to be delivering in 5 or 10 years' time.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to sprinkle the glitter over a week of higher education policy are three brilliant guests as always. In Woburn House, it's Vivian Stern, Chief Executive of Universities UK. Vivian, your hire of the week, please.
I'm going to say Keir Starmer and Bridget Phillipson being nice about the higher education sector, but I mean more seriously, being positive about the impact of expanding and widening participation in the last 30 years.
Yeah, it was nice to see. And in Old Trafford, it's Gareth Smith, Executive Director of Student Life and Strategy at UA92. Gareth, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm going to have two, Mark, if that's okay. I think my highlight I've already had so far is something seldom talked about on Wonky, is the return of university sport, British University College of Sport League yesterday, and our team's all doing very well. And then a highlight later today is we've got official opening of our business school in the centre of Manchester.
Who says we don't talk about sport on Wonky? That's not true. That's definitely not true. I'll look into that. And in North London, it's Debbie McVitty, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm having a bit of an intense week, so it's probably just as well, Gareth, the two highlights, because I'm struggling to come up with one. I think I'm going to have to say the enormous glass of wine that I plan to have on Friday evening when all the work is done and we're ready for the weekend.
Now, we start the week with Labour Party conference in Liverpool, funding and everything else that was announced there. Debbie, walk us through it.
Yeah, so Labour Party conference took place this weekend and into the beginning of this week. Lots and lots of sector engagement there, lots of fringes discussing what's going on in universities, and lots of discussion about sector finances. What, by all accounts, we didn't hear was any kind of real shift in policy from the Labour Party on sort of the big issues around higher education funding and finance, and sort of associated issues like student maintenance and kind of support for students with the cost of living crisis. I think, you know, Labour's towing a sort of tricky space here, because one of the kind of nice things, as Viv mentioned earlier, is that Labour is being much more friendly and positive about the higher education sector and about university participation in general. And that's really great to see. But of course, Labour is also very keen not to make any major spending commitments ahead of the election. They want to, you know, they are, you know, concerned about the state of the public finances, and they want to make sure that they're the things that they're pledging to do are costed, or at least have the appearance of being costed. And higher education, as we know, is just not a big priority in that kind of raft of things that might need addressing. So lots of warm words, but not very much in the way of significant policy shifts.
In terms of warm words, we've got a clip of Keir Starmer mentioning universities in a speech.
You know, I never thought I would hear a modern Conservative Prime Minister say that 50% of our children going to university was a false dream. My dad felt the disrespect of vocational skills all his life. But the solution is not, and never will be, the levelling down of working class aspiration to go to university.
Well, quite a distance of travel from the Tory Party conference in Manchester the week before, wasn't it, Vivian?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it just shows that I've kind of lost all sense of proportion, but when the Prime Minister stood up at the Conservative Party conference and used a sort of not inconsiderable section of his speech to describe the expansion of participation in the university sector as the biggest policy mistake of the last 30 years, I really found it very hard to take. I mean, I think it's an absurd statement. I think it's also strange the Conservative Party doesn't want to own its role in the success in expanding participation. And we all know, if you work in this sector, you know that you cannot widen participation if you don't expand it. And it also seems to me that, you know, those people often who say that, frankly, too many people are going to universities, they're often people who themselves benefited from a university education, whose children are likely to do so. My children are certainly likely to do so. And I keep thinking about Peter Pan, you know, this idea that, you know, if you say you don't believe in fairies, somewhere one dies. And I think maybe this is a little bit the same, that if the Prime Minister stands up and sort of describes university education without qualification, without talking about it in terms of there being sort of perhaps a very small proportion of university provision that falls below the standards we'd expect, but talking about it in general terms and using phrases like rip-off universities. I think there are probably people in the country who perhaps don't have, they don't know people who've gone to university, they don't have any direct experience of it, who decide not to go as a result and are poorer as a result of that decision. And that seems to me a great shame. So to go from that to a conference where, that sort of sense that it is unfinished business, we've got still a situation where you're twice as likely to go to university if you're from the most affluent groups in society compared to the least affluent. That seems to me something that we should work every day to address. That was slightly heartwarming, and I was very glad to see that Labour have chosen to pick this up and to make it a dividing line, frankly.
The idea that, you can hold these two concepts in your head that, skills, vocational education and training are a good thing, and higher education can also be a good thing, and universities can be important parts of the economy. I mean, I don't know why it's, we've just not heard anyone say that in so long, have we, Gareth?
No, absolutely not. And I think you're looking at it's not a linear divide between your kind of vocational education and your university education. Certainly thinking about University Academy 92, and you're right, we were founded under this government, and so they'd argue they should claim credit for us. And it's the kind of institutions like ours that have seen, we have more students from Polar 4, Quintile 1 than Quintile 5. That's due to the expansion of higher education. If you contract higher education, it's always somebody else's children that suffer that don't get to go to higher education. It won't be the Prime Minister's children, most likely, that won't get to go. And so expansion is the only way to do it. And so it was, reassuring to hear Keir Starmer kind of reiterate that there was nothing wrong with that 50% aspiration of people going on to higher education.
So lots of good vibes at this conference. Obviously, as you were saying, Debbie, quite light on detail. They can't announce too much, particularly anything relating to spending. But there is still things to be done within the current envelope, isn't there? I mean, this is what I was trying to argue on the site earlier this week.
Yeah. So one of the things that Bridget Phillipson said in her speech to conference was planning to change the way students pay for their university education. And I think we shouldn't conclude that this means that Labour has a kind of graduate tax proposal in its back pocket. I think this is reiteration of Phillipson's proposals that came out at the beginning of the summer, which basically suggested reprofiling graduate repayment in such a way as to reduce the burden of debt on graduates straight after, in the early years in the workforce. So kind of sort of loading the repayment at the point at which people are earning more. We can't say for sure, but it looks like that's kind of what is meant. And the focus there really is about sort of relieving that burden on graduates at that kind of early stage. One of the things that you wrote about on the site is about the sort of the various things that might be done by just sort of reprofiling the existing spend, and do interesting things with things like interest rates. And one of the kind of slightly very regressive things that has been done in recent years was about abolishing the interest on students' loans. And this is one of these things that is seen as very kind of punitive, slapping a big interest rate on student loans, but actually is one of the ways that the system is progressive and the people who earn more pay back more. So it's kind of it's a policy that is very popular on the face of it, but actually really really disadvantages lower earners and women who kind of take time out in the workplace and thus become kind of lower earners and that sort of thing. So actually, if you put that back on, you have quite a lot of fiscal headroom to do things like restore maintenance grants and bolster the teaching grant and all kinds of other things as well.
Yeah, Vivian, I'm fascinated to get your take on this because the last time the system was tinkered with in 2021, the Treasury gobbled up the lot of the savings and there was nothing else for graduates. There's nothing else for students, and there was nothing else for universities. And the system was made a lot more regressive in one fell swoop. And I guess that's left us with a terrible bind because there's even less wiggle room, isn't there, to make the system better. But stuff can still be done in that envelope. And I'm just really interested to know what the conversations you're having with policymakers are and what the sector is kind of formally asking for. Obviously we're trying to get out of this knot that we're tied in with all these different fiscal fiscal pressures. But at the same time, like, you know, Debbie's saying and the piece is arguing, you know, can there be a sensible way through this that stays within the rules, stays within Rachel Reeves's stated fiscal rules?
So, I mean, look, the first thing I'd say is there are some very positive signals if you read between the lines in what Bridget Phillipson has been saying publicly on the part of this problem that relates to the funding that is available to deliver teaching. There is, you know, it was said time and again on the Fringe and in the conference, you know, finding a way to address the pressures on the university teaching side is going to be very difficult, but at least they're being acknowledged. And I think that is now a pretty standard part of what Bridget says about this nest of problems. So, you know, some time ago you would hear an emphasis on the problems as they appear to students whilst they're studying, so maintenance support and the flaws in the graduate repayment system. Now you're also hearing an acknowledgement that something will need to be done about the funding available for teaching. The other way to address this is to think about the kind of short, medium term and the longer term. I think we need to just keep reiterating that one way or another, you cannot have a system which maintains quality whilst the funding for teaching declines year after year after year. And the simple objective should be to change the trajectory of that line. The unit of resource for teaching is going down, and our job is to change that so that the line curves upwards. The big question is, how long is it going to take us to get to a point where we've got a workable means for government to do that? But I think the solution is likely to be a patchwork solution. I think there have been a lot of people starting to talk about rebalancing the private and the public contribution, pointing to the way that the 2012 reforms shifted much more of the cost of higher education onto the individual. And I think that, you know, from my point of view, that patchwork has to, at some point, no matter how many people will tell you it's impossible to do it, at some point that patchwork of solutions has to involve also index linking the fee. Now, I don't think that is likely to happen before an election, but I don't think we should be shy of saying you can't keep it frozen in the long term. I also think that there's perhaps an argument that there were people who believed that 9250 or 9000 was the wrong level in the first place. And if you think about what Ed Miliband was suggesting and what was suggested in the Augur review, you might suggest that there are some people who think that perhaps a bit of fiscal drag is no bad thing here. But I think our job is to try to point out, if you keep doing that, if you don't address the trajectory of that line, you cannot possibly imagine this system will be delivering the kind of quality that we'd all expect it to be delivering in 5 or 10 years' time. So the question isn't if, it's when, I think, and that's what we need to focus policy makers' minds on.
Gareth, this question of fees is, I mean, you know, enormously vexed, isn't it? I mean, the Public First put out some polling earlier this week that we covered extensively on Wonky. They ranked different options. They put a bunch of different options in front of the public about higher education funding, including index linking fees with inflation. And even that was still extremely unpopular. I suspect partly, at least in part, because people don't understand the system and they don't understand that doing that wouldn't really cost anyone any more money or be kind of punitive on students or graduates. But you know, how do you make a case to the public when this issue is so misunderstood and so controversial?
Yeah, I think Vivian rightly articulated the kind of the need for index linking to kind of support teaching and the funding into universities. But equally, if we look at the fact that kind of the triple lock on pensions, from a kind of intergenerational fair point of view, the kind of willingness around a triple lock on pensions, and yet we see student loans go way beneath inflation, and therefore the consequence that has on kind of students, their mental health and well-being, as we'll talk about later as well. And you look at where the debate's moved in the States to the likes where Biden's offering kind of full debt relief. It's interesting why the UK is so far behind in it. Is it because kind of system of tuition fees is more immature, arguably, in the UK than it has been in the States? But certainly you'd think over time, you're going to see that kind of policies like Biden's proposing kind of being more popular in the UK. But right now, I think it's asking too much from the electorate for them to understand the RAB rate and the changes that Michelle Donlan's already made. But I think what we need is that real patchwork of solutions that Vivian mentioned. mentioned. I think there's some hope in some of what is detailed in LLE. I know Matt Weston's been querying this. So right now, under the system, there's no real incentive for higher education institutions to offer accelerated degrees because our fees are capped at 20% lower. If you unlinked that and enabled us to charge those kind of full fees, it still saves the exchequer because the loan overall that a student would get would still be over 2 years rather than three. So I think there's relatively simple things that could be done as part of that patchwork of solutions that give us a better system. And fundamentally, we need to ensure that any system for the student is not regressive in the nature that it is right now. Those that earn the most, that benefit the most from higher education should ultimately be those that pay the most, not those that take a career break or earn just above the threshold for a full 40 years to end up paying over time with the level of interest as it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Vivian, I'm sort of pleased on the one hand that you think that, you know, there is a message that can get through there to Labour shadow ministers. Is that what you're saying? Do you think that they're receptive to the idea that that line, that curve has to start ticking upwards at some point despite the political risks?
Well, you know, the work that we've been doing in UK is about sort of establishing first that there is a problem and that it's not a problem that is just should be of concern to the university system itself, but should be concerned to anybody who has a stake in the performance of the higher education system in the UK, which is, by the way, everybody. And that's the base camp, right? So establish that there is something, you know, happening here that isn't in our national interest. And the next step, I think, is trying to set out a range of measures which are, you know, politically achievable. And I think that's why time is a factor in that, in finding that solution. And the third thing is about trying to move the debate on the way that we finance higher education on just a notch. I think there was a huge missed opportunity both in the 2004-05 period when the first variable, as they weren't intended to be, 3,000 fee system was introduced, and again in 2000, between 2010 and 2012. The system is designed to be a contributory system. It's designed in a way that the state backs the individual risk. So you go to university, you are overwhelmingly likely to benefit from that both financially and in all sorts of other ways. But, you know, the because it's also in the national interest that a significant proportion of our population goes to university, the state stands behind you and says, look, if it doesn't work out for you and you don't end up making a huge amount of money, we're going to pick up the tab. And it's intended to be a balance. It was intended to, you know, to implement two legs of what Deering proposed in 1996 or whenever he published his report, because higher education is both a private and a public good, the contribution should be drawn from both the individual and the state. And the way that's expressed in our system is largely through the subsidy on the loan. But that feels like, you know, somehow there's a failure when government doesn't recoup the full loan. And I would say we've got to try and change the political understanding of that. It's not a failure. It's an expression of that shared risk. And that may sound like a very sort of ambitious thing to do. But as I said, I think we've got to see the solution to this problem as something that has we've got a short-term problem, and then there is something that I think we will only be able to do over a period of a few years.
I think that the fact that balance is out of whack is almost unarguable. I mean, the RAB charge is down to 13%, you know, mostly at the expense of graduates and lower earning graduates, and universities didn't get any extra cash while that change was made. I mean, I completely agree. The balance, there needs to be kind of some kind of restoring of the force here. But you know, it's 60 years on from Robbins as well. So as you know, everyone's talking about higher education reviews and the kind of whether or not it would be advisable to kind of look, you know, more seriously at the system, or whether we need to just fix that balance you described so well, Vivian. or whether we need to go back to really to first principles and advocate, you know, particularly a new government perhaps saying, okay, let's do a root and branch, you know, Robbins or Deering style review of higher education. What do we want out of it? What's its role in society, and how does everyone pay for it? Do you think that's realistic, Debbie?
I don't know that it is a very good idea. I think, on the one hand, you want to, you know, I think looking at the system as a whole, and I think, you know, things like, for example, the interaction between knowledge exchange activity in a region and the graduates' skills in that region is really kind of sensible policy approach. You know, you want to kind of see how these things connect up, and you want to put the right policy things in place to be able to, to make sure that that works. So that's kind of, I think, you know, there's always a case to kind of look at something in the round and say, well, let's do that. That said, I'm just not convinced that this is the right time to do that. Mainly because it's not, you know, we have to be an independent review. It would take several years, during which time, you know, the problems that we know exist in the system would get worse. It wouldn't be enough time for there to be kind of sufficient turning round of the economy to make everybody feel kind of confident that any recommendations that come out could be implemented in full. So we'd end up with a kind of bodge. So I think, actually, I'm not convinced. I think there are kind of challenges in the system. I think some bits probably don't work as well together as they do. But I'm not convinced that the problems are so kind of systemic and so long term, such that would need to be addressed by a review would offset the need for there just to be addressing of the immediate kind of financial pressures on students and universities. So I think, you know, the focus really needs to be on kind of sorting those out. While perhaps, you know, and they're probably, you know, we will be due, you know, towards the end of the end of the next parliament and another look, and I think universities could be quite sort of proactive in sort of articulating that role for themselves and kind of looking to kind of address or, you know, identify some of those moments where things aren't working quite as well and propose solutions. And I know kind of Viv is very on that, and so I'm really not convinced that kind of, you know, sort of getting everyone around the table and saying let's have a tertiary review is the right way forward, although I can see why it would be tempting.
Vivian, I have to move us on, but just in a sentence, would you advocate for a big review, or do you advocate one when lobbying politicians?
Look, I think we want to keep, in a sense, we want to keep the solution part of this issue out of an election, because I don't think that electoral politics will help us get the right solution. So the solution, whatever the next government does, I think I would support something that would help us arrive at a conclusion about that the other side of an election. The danger with a review, as Debbie has said, is it kicks things into the long grass. So in a sense, what we've been doing with the National Conversation is doing the review before the review happens. And I think the challenge for us is make sure everybody understands there's an issue and be ready with a workable patchwork of solutions the other side of an election. Now, I don't think that will necessarily take a review. And I do slightly share Debbie's view that that's kicking it into the long grass. But, you know, if there is a mechanism that can get you cross-party support, take the politics out of it and give us something that will be sustainable in the long term, then it might be worth a bit of a delay.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Annabel Kiernan, Pro Vice Chancellor Academic at Staffordshire University.
And I'm Kira Bunting, Education Research and Evaluation Manager, also at Staffordshire University.
Student basic needs is an area which is occupying much of our time when it comes to understanding why some students aren't achieving their potential and why some struggle to get off the starting blocks. Taking into account the impact of the pandemic and rising living costs, we've carried out a pilot survey with just over 100 students to directly ask them about the insecurities they face during their university life. The survey was inspired by work led by the Hope Centre across a network of US colleges, and our findings have been shared in fringe events hosted by the Purpose Coalition at both the Conservative and Labour Party conferences.
The results paint a stark picture, revealing a range of insecurities which impact students' well-being, mental health, and engagement. Our findings confirm that nearly all students, 93%, are worried about the cost of living, and 10% are not eating at least once a month because they can't afford to. Added to that, 25% of students reported that they move between homes 3 to 5 times in a single year, and 2/3 were having to ask friends and family to help cover the cost of food and for paying bills.
So the responsibility is on us, educators and policymakers, to act on these findings by developing and integrating targeted support that address these insecurities. And we also have to adapt our teaching methods and delivery to align with the genuine needs of our students. For more information, you can read our article, which links through to the report of the pilot study.
Now, ministers at DfE have written to the sector about anti-Semitism in HE. Vivian, tell us what's going on.
Right. Well, we have obviously seen a week in which universities have had to provide advice to their students about how to engage in a debate about what's happening in Israel in a way that is compliant with the law. What Gillian Keegan and Robert Halfen has done, in fact, is exactly what we did on on Monday morning, which is just put out a note to remind people that Hamas is a terrorist organization. It's therefore subject to legal restrictions, which prevent people expressing support for it or glorifying acts of terrorism. And I think what Robert Halfen and Gillian Keegan are doing is reminding people that I think although this is a topic which is always one of the real crunch points when you come to managing campus relations and balancing the rights of people to express views with the need to stay within the law and to prevent anti-Semitism or other forms of hate speech being permitted. It's just one of those times where you need to remind people that there is a red line and they shouldn't cross it. And to be honest, that was precisely the point of our press statement on Monday, which was very, very simple and straightforward. We simply put out a statement to remind people that Hamas is a proscribed terrorist organisation and signalling support, including moral support or expressing an opinion or belief that is supported, is a criminal offence.
All right, lots to unpack here. Gareth, maybe I'm being naive, but it seems rather dispiriting to say the least that people have to be reminded that Hamas is a terrorist organisation. Is there a wider problem at play here in terms of anti-Semitism in higher education?
I think, Mark, it's been an ongoing issue over years and decades, indeed, on campuses where it is a source of tension in campuses. And clearly we need to make sure that kind of Jewish students on campuses feel safe. And I think that there is the need for advice around it in terms of really reiterating, you're right, that kind of Hamas are a terrorist organization in terms of what they do. These are not freedom fighters. These are terrorists taking actions that they did in Israel. But equally going further that, not equating then support for a Palestinian state or a two-state solution being support for Hamas. And I do think people need educating about that. And I can think of certain slogans, which you might see chanted on kind of campuses, which effectively call for the destruction of the state of Israel. And therefore, absolutely advice is needed to make sure that our students feel completely safe. Obviously, the right to kind of protest about what's happened in Israel and indeed what's happening in Gaza is completely needs to be there. But absolutely, I think guidance to ensure our kind of students and staff feel safe. I saw a former colleague of mine expressing her fear about she didn't feel safe to go and see Golda at the cinema, something she'd been planning to do for ages. And we clearly can't have an environment on campuses where Jewish students are afraid that they might go to a cinema screening and be faced with protest.
And Debbie, one of the other things that sort of slightly troubles me is this kind of whataboutery that goes on when something like this happens. You know, there are people who just can't, for whatever reason, bring themselves to condemn, you know, an atrocious act of violence without having to say, well, there is another side to this. You know, would the response be the same if Hamas had done an attack inside the States, for example?
It is genuinely hard to think about having the conversation about what the appropriate response is, in part because comparisons don't sort of work, because this is a very, very distinctive situation. So I think I'm probably not going to kind of say if it was this parallel case, then this would be the case. However, I do think it's really important to say that if you have decided that as an organization you are going to say things about acts of atrocity, you know, in the UK, in the US, around the world, you know, whatever it is, then you can't then leave out other acts of atrocity because it's uncomfortable. And, you know, and I think it's also completely legitimate for universities to say, actually, do you know what, as an organization, our job is not to take a view. Our job is not to kind of do this. And I think, you know, that there's a kind of legitimate debate about whether it's important to kind of be moral leaders in that way, or whether it's important to be able to kind of say, actually, we don't have an official kind of, because this is a very kind of sensitive issue, and we don't have a position on this. And that's, you know, that is also true of terrorist activity worldwide. And I say this as someone who grew up in a region kind of affected by terrorism. And, you know, they're always, you know, it's you know, behavior is always atrocious. And there is also, you know, a political context to it. I think the problem comes if you are kind of being, if you're picking and choosing about what moral atrocities you stand up for. And this is essentially the kind of criticism that GA students are having of their institutions right now, saying, look, you know, you can't chop logic on this particular issue. It's got to be, you know, you've either got our backs or you don't.
Yeah. I mean, Vivian, I want to pick that up with this question of moral leadership and how you see the sector's role. I mean, take an example of the 2015 attacks in Paris, the terrorist attacks. The sector was lining up to condemn those, issuing statements, flying flags at half mast. And, you know, there wasn't any discussion qualifying it. It was just accepted that that was wrong. And on a moral level, there has to be some calling out of that. And I think, you know, it's as a Jewish person, it's quite painful and very difficult to understand why people in society don't do the same when those attacks happen, either in Israel or on Jewish people in general. Mm-hmm. And it does look like there are different standards. And I mean, David Baddiel wrote a brilliant book about this, which I really recommend to readers, called Jews Don't Count, to listeners, sorry, about why that might be, about how Jews are treated differently in these debates. I strongly recommend it. But do you accept that there is a case that universities have a wider moral leadership role? And if so, kind of where does it end? And do you agree with Debbie that you know, if some atrocities are bad, then we have to accept that all are, and we have to treat them in a similar way?
Look, the first thing is what has happened. The attack on Israel is horrific, and I've got family in Israel. I'm in touch with people who sort of are, you know, they're really very, very bleak about what's coming next. And I'm not Jewish myself, but my family on my father's side is. My dad's a Holocaust survivor. The kind of thing that Daniel Finkelstein wrote in the Times a couple of days ago, I highly recommend people read. You know, it speaks to a little part of me, because I sort of know that there's a part of this discussion which those people who have some understanding of the way that Jews have been driven, you know, from place to place over centuries, you know, appreciate that perhaps isn't more widely appreciated. I think that it's important to use this moment to remind people that this is a very, very complex set of circumstances with very, very deep roots on all sides. But having said all of that, it's for individual university to decide whether they make a statement on events in the world. I just always, you know, from our point of view in the UK, I think you have to be very careful when you do and don't do that, because the question legitimately is then the one that you've just asked. If you speak out about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and then you decide not to speak out about something like this, then it implies that you think one somehow has a lesser importance. My own view is that our focus should be right now on making sure that universities provide the guidance and support to students to enable them to understand how to take part in this debate without stepping over a red line. And that doesn't seem entirely simple to me. And that's why in our statement on Monday, we just tried to stick very, very simply to the fact that Hamas is a terrorist organization and what has happened is a terrorist atrocity, and you cannot express support for that within the law. Now, I don't think that's the same as expressing support for the Palestinian people or expressing a view on the two-state solution. What I think you have to try and do is help people who are trying to express strongly held view to stay within the law.
I mean, Gareth, there is, or, you know, many people believe, you know, there's a problem with anti-Semitism in higher education, as there is across all parts of society. But, you know, you look at some of the reports over the last few days of some of the things that this guidance from DfE and the UK are trying to make sure doesn't happen. You see the way that the attacks are described on social media by lots of different sorts of academics. You see, you know, there's been lots of video clips surface of people saying pretty horrific things at protests and vigils and whatnot. And it does remind us that there is a anti-Semitism problem in HE that's been there for a long time, but hasn't gone away and doesn't appear to be anytime soon. If anything appears appears to be getting worse in some ways. And I wonder what they're, you know, what we should be doing about that in terms of a sector response separate to the events of this week.
I think you're right. We need to kind of question ourselves and question the kind of response that it's been. I think back to my own experience. I was a student studying abroad at 9/11, and you think that I was roundly condemned in terms of the acts of kind of the of ISIS terrorist attacks there, and we've probably not seen that same level of condemnation in terms of the atrocities that have happened in Israel, despite the fact we've obviously seen from Netanyahu equating Hamas as being just as evil, if not more evil than ISIS in terms of what they've done. But I think the important thing is supporting our students so that they feel safe on our campuses. You're right, this has been an ongoing issue, I think, back to kind of all the time when Luciana Berger and others were involved in NUS, and that was an issue back then and clearly remains an issue today. So I think the key bit is we need to make sure that all our students feel supported and safe and able to debate this in the right way. So our Jewish students feel safe, but equally we're aware that students with families in Gaza right now will be feeling particularly tense and upset about the possibilities of kind of further Israeli military action. And so I think the key bit is just supporting our students about how they have this debate and accepting that there will be people who go really struggle as a result of everything that's happened with direct family involved.
And Debbie, I mean, as we've alluded to, this does raise a bunch of other questions about freedom of speech on campus, which is, you know, a piece of work that is coming down the tracks at us with consultation and the bill that's being put in force and the new director of free speech. This certainly adds context to, or you know, the challenges that Arif Ahmed, the new free speech champion, is going to face, isn't it?
Yeah. So Arif Ahmed, the new director for freedom of speech and academic freedom at OFS, made his sort of big first you know UK public statement, and he brought the broad defence of freedom of speech. I think, you know, moments like this really is where the rubber hits the road in terms of what that means. And I think, you know, Viv is completely right in the sense that, you know, there is actually it is to an extent pretty cut and dried, because if you have this is, you know, there is a kind of category of speech that is outside the law in this context when you're talking about endorsing or supporting or glorifying acts of terrorism. So in that sense, Ahmed's kind of, you know, very much on point when he says, you know, you can say what you like as long as you say it within the law. And, you know, that could be upsetting and difficult for people. But, you know, as long as it's legal, that's fine. And it's, you know, universities that need to protect it. I think I think that's sort of a little bit, I think that's probably an optimistic perspective if you think about the sorts of claims that could be made in the context of a very heightened and emotional, you know, intense debate, you know, it, you know, again, against a backdrop of you know of sort of very very difficult events. It is not, I think, clear at this time what the job of universities is to promote freedom of speech in that context, or what, you know, what promoting might even look like. You know, is the job to should universities be actively trying to kind of enable a debate about this? Is a debate even the right way to address something of this kind of scale and horror? You know, it seems very kind of it just seems like a kind of like not a kind of not where people's heads are going to be. You know, it just sort of seems off base. So I think, you know, it's in some ways I think it, you know, as these kind of moments occur, thinking about them in the context of free speech legislation, thinking about, you know, OFS is going to go to consultation in the coming months about how the kind of national complaint scheme should work in practice, about, you know, about the new condition of registration that will be laid down around securing and promoting freedom of speech and academic freedom in universities. You know, I think it's really, really important that everyone thinks quite carefully about what can reasonably be expected of universities, what universities, you know, and how universities can balance that question of sort of saying supporting students, giving the right advice about how to stay within the law for the students that want to have the debate, but also sometimes saying to the students, it's okay if you don't want to have the debate, this is really tough, and the thing that you need right now is support and you know, and to feel safe. And it, that's a really tough, you know, road to hoe, but, you know, we sort of knew that, and these moments will create opportunities to reflect on how that can be made to work as best as possible.
Gareth, there's been a discussion this week in Labour Party conference in Liverpool about mental health and regulating it, and should the RFS get involved or not? Can you walk us through it?
Yes, absolutely, Mark. So debate at Social Market Foundation organised event around the kind of student mental health crisis, or indeed the broader mental health crisis that we see across society. But we're aware that students are kind of suffering more than others of the same age. We then saw kind of commitments from Wes Streeting, kind of friend of the podcast, around kind of as Shadow Health Secretary, around the broader commitments around mental health. But that's how that would relate into the higher education sector. And Matt Weston raising the prospect of whether it should be a regulated approach. Thinking about it myself, I'm slightly fearful of regulation. It absolutely is a priority for us at University Academy 92, but the OFS have allocated us £2,622 towards our approach towards mental health and transition, and it would cost us far more to almost report on that than the huge amounts more than that we spend on supporting our students with regard to their mental health and the challenges that they face around increasing rent costs, student inflation, loneliness, etc., when we're not seeing kind of student loan and maintenance support kind of go up in line with inflation.
Yeah. And we actually got a clip of what Weston said.
And I guess what I'm saying with mental health is that I would expect that all institutions have a good practice in terms of the approach to mental health, sexual harassment and assault on campus, that there are these practices. I'm not saying that it should necessarily not be within OFS, but I do would like to believe that all institutions will have protocols in place. Now, who actually ensures they are in place? I'm not sure. I'm not necessarily saying it should be the OFS, but we must make sure that there are no gaps, that this is not a risk. It's not just down to, oh, well, you happen to be at the wrong institution. They didn't have a protocol in place. We do need to make sure these things happen. So Vivian's right. It's not really for a regulator to be doing that, but we do need to ensure that institutions are doing the right thing.
So Vivian, I'm interested to know where you think the line is on OFS and student mental health, and to what extent it should be getting involved. I know some of your comments this week at Liverpool may have been misinterpreted, perhaps, but I thought it was good to give you the opportunity to tell us what you think.
Well, I had a bit of, a kind of polite spat with Jim Dickinson on the site about this week. I don't think that there should be a condition of regulation around universities' approach to supporting student mental health. And I think that was what was being implied in the letter which Robert Halfen wrote encouraging universities to take up the mental health charter. And there was a sort of paragraph at the end of it that said, you know, or else. And what my point is, we've got this regulator has got too much on its plate. We need to strip back the focus of the regulator so that it can do a great job and inspire public trust and confidence in quality and access particularly, and free up the resources within institutions to devote to supporting their students, which is their primary, what the funding they do have, tightly constrained, should be primarily directed to. It is not saying mental health, student mental health, is none of the OFS's business. So I guess if Matt and I had sort of had a longer conversation, we'd probably find that we maybe agreed with each other. I think my sort of broad view is there shouldn't be a condition of regulation around this registration.
But should there be kind of anything centrally at all, or do you think this is a matter for universities to kind of work out for themselves?
Well, we are. I mean, the take up of the charter is pretty widespread. We're working with the group led by Edward Peck to support that. We're also making sure we gather feedback on the charter. But beyond that, you know, we need to do something about the kind of the degree to which the health service and the university system can work efficiently together in an era of just rising demand around mental health, which I think in the end is going to outstrip both the capacity in the health service and the capacity in universities to support it. I think that's a very, very important. It's more important that we get that right, I think, than that universities get sort of pulled up short if they're seen to be somehow not doing everything that they might be expected to do. I think that's just, it's not helpful to see this as a regulatory challenge. I think it's something which requires collaboration, particularly between universities and the health service.
So I think this is fascinating, because what Matt is saying at that fringe is that the regulator that is constituted hasn't got the tools available to it to do the sorts of things we might want it to do, which is very sort of different in some ways from kind of should student mental health be regulated? What he's describing is a scenario where he's saying we absolutely want people to be doing some stuff, and this I think is true of a lot of the things that will come out of Edward Peck's mental health task force in government, but we don't want it to be kind of codified in legislation or in regulation. And I think there's really good reasons for that, not least because the sorts of things that you might talk about when, if you're talking about specific support for mental health, there's a sort of argument for a basket of things that constitute good practice, but actually a lot of that is integrated into the broader thing around teaching and learning, around access, around things like positive research cultures and high quality supervision for PGRs. I mean, the sort mental health sort of is sort of woven through the whole thing, and that this is what UUK's step change framework and the mental health charter is really trying to address. So I think the idea of sort of regulating on it becomes a bit sort of tricky. So I think the thing that we probably need to think about is what are the kind of actions short of regulation, and is it OFS or is it another body that should be empowered or enabled to do that? In some ways it's not very helpful to kind of harken back to Hefke, but this is exactly the sort of thing that Hefke would have kind of caused to happen, through mechanisms like funding, and OFS is capable of doing that, but there's always that kind of threat of it having turning into a condition of regulation and sort of the levers available being insufficient to achieve that kind of good practice. And certainly I think also there's a question mark about whether UUK is the right body as well, because of course it has no kind of enforcing or at all. So they think that there's something in the middle there, and we haven't quite worked out as a sector what the theory of change is to cause things to happen without using kind of very blunt tools like regulation.
Gareth, I'm interested to know how you think universities could work together on tackling this issue.
I think there's very much kind of the case that universities can share best practice and different institutions share best practice and potentially come together to provide the best kind of mental health support. Thinking from a small provider perspective, kind of something around like CBT therapy would be something that we could provide directly ourselves, but maybe if we work with other providers, you can provide a broader range of kind of mental health support across the different students. And so I think the ability of institutions to work together, share best practice, that's absolutely what OFS should be focusing on, rather than potentially a move towards further regulation.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Vivian, Gareth, Dabby, and Michael, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.